You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. This is episode number 75, Practical Aspects of Subgroup Detection, an interview with Neshtet Gunzoy. Excited to say that we are launching again our leadership program, the Effective Statistician Leadership Program. It launches in November and you can sign up for it during the period now. There's a landing page already where you can go to. It's at the Effective Statistician, and there you will find the leadership program. And of course, then you can sign up there. We have this program designed for statisticians to strengthen your leadership skills so that you can maximize your impact at work, even if you don't have direct reports. So this is not something for, you know, restricted to supervisors or becoming supervisors. This is really for every statistician. And it's a program that is a mixture of webinars, podcasts, and moderated small group discussions. And we have, for the current cohort, we have students that coming from pharma, from CRO, and from academia, and with very, very different levels of experience. Because we think all statisticians can be leaders. And we have really, really nice success stories from the leadership program. So there was, for example, one statistician that worked in a CRO and that, where the program completely changed his mind in terms of how he sees his work, what he can do. And he now sees his contribution very differently, and through that is able to deliver much better quality to the customers of the CRO, and have this bigger point of view in mind, and be a relevant discussion partner for higher ups in his organization. Or the other statistician that, because of the program, reached out to other people that were using his data and were seeing that they were using the analysis results or the data that they received in a very, very poor and difficult way, so that they needed, you know, a complete day to make a decision. And now he can help them to make the decisions in 5 minutes, because he understood kind of the bigger picture. He saw his colleagues in a different way and really took ownership there. So really, really nice examples, and would be so great if you could benefit from that as well. If you want to find out more, go to the Effective Statistician homepage and learn there at theeffectivestatistician.com/course, and there you will find all the further details. It would be awesome to have you in the program. Now, in today's episode, we'll actually also talk quite a lot about leadership skills, because managing these frustrations about subgroup analysis requires lots of leadership skills, and that will be kind of a theme throughout this episode. And Neshtet is a really, really nice presenter, and it was a really nice episode to record with him. And the background for this episode is a presentation that he gave at the PSI conference in 2019, and it was such a good presentation. Actually, he delivered two very good presentations that he received the Effective Statistician Presentation Award, Best Presentation Award for these presentations there. So join me for a really nice discussion with Neshtet about practical aspects of subgroup detection. This podcast is created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. The reduced rate is only £20 per year for non-high-income countries and £95 for high-income countries. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode. And this time I have a guest here with me, with whom I'm actually working together for quite some time on various topics. And he did an awesome job in presenting about this at the PSI conference in 2019. And that was so good that he actually won an award for doing the best presentation. And today we'll talk a little bit about the presentation skills, but mostly we will focus actually on the content of his presentation, which of course, as a member of PSI, you can find on the video on demand content library. Just go to psiweb.org. And if you are not yet a member, you should really become one. So, welcome, Nested. How are you doing?
Hi, Alexander. I'm very good. Thank you.
Okay. So as most of the listeners probably don't know you, maybe you can give a little bit of an introduction of what you have been interested in so far in your career and what your life within pharma has been up to now.
Yeah, so I'm Necdet Gunsoy. I work at GSK currently. I'm a director in analytics and innovation. I know it sounds very fancy, but basically our group is sort of a stats consultancy group where we support teams in stats methodology, study design, decision making, benefit risk, subgroup analyses, all those kinds of things. And we mainly operate in sort of the reimbursement space, but we do a lot of consulting in the development space as well, to make sure that that the studies are being designed in the right way to help us achieve reimbursement. I started off in clinical statistics when I first joined GSK. So I was working in respiratory and clinical statistics and, you know, had all the different kinds of headaches that the statisticians have. You know, we're talking about subgroup analyses today. So I did a couple of, you know, AMNOG processes with all the analyses. And
AMNOG, by the way, if you don't know as a listener, that's the German laws that regulates the HTA submissions in Germany.
Yeah, so if you ever had a list of 300, 400 subgroup analyses, that's the one. That's what it's for. And so, you know, I've naturally gained an interest in subgroup analyses, more in like in an efficiency domain initially, and then later on more methodological, which was the emphasis of the presentation. And I'm also have interest in benefit risk assessment, the quantitative kind, machine learning, and decision making in general. So the presentation was around subgroup detection, which kind of couples together my interest in subgroup analyses and machine learning a bit together. So that's how it all came about.
Yeah, and of course you also had a really, really nice presentation as a benefit risk section of the conference. But we're not talking about that so much. And if you want to learn more about benefit risk, just scroll back in your player. We actually had a couple of very, very nice episodes recently on benefit risk with benefit risk special interest group that, we both, Neustadt and myself, have been working on quite a lot. Me recently a little bit less due to other commitments, but yes, that was also a very, very nice thing. And all these kind of different things are, of course, interrelated. You talked a little bit about problems or headaches, and I think UMNOC with this requirements to present every patient-relevant endpoint by every subgroup that is pre-specified, it's of course, a big headache for people. But a little bit in general, why do you think subgroups such a big, headache for lots of statisticians all the time?
I think it's a bit of an irritation for statisticians, because I guess we think of it more in a numerical perspective, right? If you do enough subgroup analyses, you'll find one significant interaction by chance. And we know this. We say this all the time, but the people who are requesting the analyses, they know it, but they still want these subgroup analyses anyway. And I think that's the point where it gets a bit frustrating, is that eventually, if you do enough of them, you'll find something, and that something is probably by chance. I mean, if you've done, if you do 20 of them, there'll be one by chance. What might be a frustration sometimes is if that one generates another 20, and then it goes on and on. And there's always a lot of the time, I think most subgroup analysis requests have some sort of clinical justification to them. So once the result is there, there's always a rationale for the finding. And so that's kind of maybe the frustrating point. Another one maybe is just the amount of processes involved in actually undertaking it. And every time, if it's a separate request every time, the organizational burden becomes quite high, and I think that might be frustrating as well. So rather, I think some statisticians might very much prefer to have all the requests in one go, and then that's a big project and it gets done in one swoop. It's a lot easier to manage. So that might also be a frustration. And also, I guess these subgroup analyses, they don't come from just one stakeholder. One subgroup analysis comes from one, another one comes from another. You get about 100 from Germany. And then, you have all of these, some come from reimbursement space, some come from there. And it just becomes all of this. It just becomes very difficult to manage.
And if we talk today about subgroup analysis, it's really about looking into how, let's say females separate from males and things like that. It's not so much in looking into a specific group and then ignoring the rest of it, isn't it?
Well, so I think you have different, I think it all depends on what the purpose of the analysis is. So sometimes you want to know, I think it is best practice to always have the complement. So if you're interested in males, you would look at females as well, because then you would maybe just compare to the overall effect, which is not necessarily the right way to do it. So you always should always have the complement to compare against. The presentation was sort of broadly about subgroup analysis, but it was more around subgroup detection. So maybe there where you're interested in where it's not like pre-specified subgroups saying male, female, or age 50 versus more than 50. It's more of a here are the variables, and try and find a subgroup kind of exercise. But the principles are the same.
In your career as a clinical statistician, can you give an example where you were really frustrated about some subgroup analysis?
So I think Obviously, there are many times. I'm going to try and use something else than Amnog. it comes quite often with when you have, for example, biomarkers. But you know, biomarkers are probably the most headache generating variable for statisticians, because obviously there are infinite ways you can dichotomize a biomarker or a continuous variable, because they're continuous. So I think it just becomes very frustrating when it's sort of, well, yes, you can look at this threshold, that threshold, or what happens if we change it to this threshold, or what happens if we look at quartiles, tertiles, deciles, you know, just the list is like endless. Whereas, you know, when it's male, female, there's only one analysis I can do with that, and then I'm done, and, you know, there's not much else I can do. So, you know, and then, you know, with the continuous variable, then it's, well, what if you analyze it as a continuous variable, and then you start looking at you know, fractional polynomials, all of that stuff. So it becomes very frustrating because the possibilities are endless, and really depending on what the purpose of the analysis is, the approach would be very different. So you know, that was kind of one of the points of the presentation as well, was really focusing on the purpose, particularly with this kind of biomarker. If the purpose is to, for example, truly understand the underlying relationship between this continuous covariate, which can be a biomarker or anything else, then that should be a modeling approach, right? You have to try and put some sort of model that is based on that covariate and try and model the treatment effect as a function of that covariate, however functional form you've imposed on it, and try and figure out what the best functional form for that covariate is. So that would be that specific purpose. If the purpose was, well, actually, you know, I want to find a patient subgroup by this biomarker that gives me twice the, you know, two times more efficacy than my overall population, then obviously what you're looking now is, what is the threshold I need to apply on that biomarker to get that kind of benefit? That's a very different question. And that might be more, you know, applying thresholds until you get to somewhere where you're at that level.
I think there's a couple of points. I think that the first is kind of this frustration about what is the right cut point. Is there, you know, having lots of cut points for the same things. I've seen analysis plans where, you know, they looked into age and they had three or four different ways to categorize it. One thing that I actually discourage very much is these, let's say, data-driven thresholds like median or quartiles or something like this, because it's really difficult then to pool across different studies. You know, you have one median from one study and another median from the other study, and then you want to kind of pool things across studies, and but the subgroups don't fit. And so I find that quite irritating at times. And
well, I guess medians have their place in very limited applications. For example, if you don't have a clinical threshold already established, then you might just, you know, use a median, but then that median would become the new threshold, right?
But then I would actually, I think I would look at the median and then take a relevant, you know, number close to the median and put mm-hmm. that fixed. So I don't know, if your median now yes. of age is 52, then I would say, okay, let's compare beyond and below 50. And that is also something that you will later put in some papers or something like this, because you'll probably not put in the paper, oh, mm-hmm. if you're 52 and 2 months and 6 days old, then that's a threshold. But what really comes through is a lot of frustration is about, there's so much ambiguity in the original research question, isn't it? So it's kind of, oh, let's do subgroup analysis. And then you think about, well, you could have lots of different approaches to it, because you could have, you know, the underlying question could be so much different. Yeah. So I think that is really one, maybe, you know, summarizes the biggest frustration, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So I think, that was really in the presentation, I have three key things. And the first one is purpose, really identified the purpose. What is the research question? What are you trying to show? What is the end product? How is it going to be used? Because that will obviously determine everything else and the approach that you want to use. Yes. So in the presentation, actually, I had an example where I ask three questions for the same data, and they can lead to very different approaches. But I think generally from the client side, I'm just calling them clients, but from the stakeholder side, they might think that those three questions are actually the same question, but from a statistical viewpoint or a methodological viewpoint, they're actually very different. And the questions I had, for example, if you say, I want to identify a subgroup of patients with enhanced efficacy, that's very specific. We're saying what we want to do is take the whole population and identify one subgroup within them that will have higher efficacy, and generally that higher efficacy should have a threshold, because obviously bigger subgroup might have less enhanced efficacy, smaller subgroup more enhanced, so you need some sort of threshold attached to that. But that's one very specific question. If I'm saying I want to identify different subgroups of patients with differential efficacy, now the question is very different. What I'm trying to do is segregate my population into different patients with different characteristics that have different efficacy expected. So that's not a one subgroup answer to a question, that's multiple subgroups. And then on the flip side, if I'm saying I want to identify clinical characteristics which help predict enhanced efficacy, that lends itself maybe to a more model-based approach where we're relating an efficacy estimate to a regression formula. So where, continuous covariates are modeled as continuous and so on. So yep. Then you can say, well, for this combination of characteristics, I have this expected efficacy. So that's much less subgroup. That's more like an individual prediction. So those, they might all be the same question when it comes from the stakeholder side, but actually they will have very different approaches. And the worst thing would be to do the wrong approach or do too much, more than necessary to answer a question.
Really good point. It's like with the Estimands framework as well. Someone asks you, okay, what's the efficacy of this compound? And you say, I think we need to have a little bit longer discussion here before I can give you the answers that you are really after. And here it's the same with the subgroups approach. It's about active listening at the beginning to nail down what is really the most important thing. And it could easily happen that, even a team, everybody thinks they are talking about the same thing, and de facto, everybody thinks about something different. And so there's some effort required to bring the team together and talk through these different possibilities with the team to help them understand, okay, what are we really looking forward? What is kind of the conclusions that we will write in the paper or that we will communicate with stakeholders? How will that look like in the end? Thinking from the end helps a lot to get away with this frustration. What are the other two steps that you mentioned?
So the first one was purpose again. And so the two other things, and this is generally in sort of a more of a detection space, but I think it applies to any kind of subgroup analysis, is to define the outcomes and then to define the parameters. And the outcomes is particularly important here. And it depends on the question. So what are the outcomes that you're interested in? One of the major frustrations of subgroup analysis is that you might have two different subgroups for two different outcomes. So how do you use that information? It's very difficult. So we need to think about that upfront. So what are the outcomes? How are they defined? How are they categorized? All of those kinds of specific things. And the last one, of course, is to define the parameters. So the parameters are actually what are the covariates that you're going to include in the explanation of those outcomes. And of course, then there's a side question to that. Well, actually, I can have lots of predictors. Some of them might be things that I want to adjust for, which are of importance to adjust for, but they might not be clinically relevant. So for example, region. Yeah, region is usually important to adjust for when you carry out analyses, but you don't want to predict something based on region, right? Because the most useless thing would be to say, well, actually, the best subgroup is this country. No, that doesn't really make sense. What are the clinical characteristics that mean that that region has better efficacy, for example? So, you know, region is good to adjust for because it accounts for things like standard of care and all of these other things that maybe isn't measured very well or adjusted for in your model. But obviously, in a prediction side, it's not something you want to use for predicting. So you want to split those variables out as well.
Yeah. It doesn't isn't helpful if you say to the patients, move to France because then you will be better off. It's yeah.
And I guess on the outcome side, yeah.
Yeah. So these three steps is first purpose, defining the endpoints, and having a good discussion about the covariates. This is the three steps, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. So in terms of, let's maybe dig a little bit deeper into the purpose. What are the kind of more granular steps that we need to think about the purpose?
So I think that's probably the most difficult step, and it's probably the step that requires the most time. And I think that what is important there is really to bring together all of the stakeholders and have a clear discussion about what the purpose of the analysis is. And as you mentioned previously, I think the key determinant here is to focus on what the end result is. So focus the team on identifying what the end result is. So what is the end result? What is the table you want to see in a publication, or what is the table you want to share with your customers? What is it that you want to see? Because depending on what you want to see, I need to decide what I'm going to do, because what I'm going to do is going to be different depending on what you want to see. So, and they might have a very clear idea of what they actually want to see, which is probably very different from what they're asking you to do. And so basically, I think the best way is to really start from that end result, because they have probably a very clear idea of what they want to actually see. And maybe it might be something that's already in a different paper that they want to replicate. And that really helps. So focus on the end result, and then we can work our way back from there. And I think really the key thing is to really don't assume that the team actually know what they want. So, you know, when they're asking for something and they say something, or they ask a particular question and you think that they're asking that question, you know, that the words are actually the right words to use in that question, don't assume that. So you really need to probe into it. And also don't assume that they know how they want it. And especially, I think one of the first slide that I shared, and that's also in the purpose thing, you always start with purpose, because what you don't want to do is start with like a method. Well, that's probably the worst thing, but it happens. So for example, I think a lot of statisticians would have had this question asked to them. It might be, oh, can we use machine learning to, or deep learning, whatever they want to, can we use machine learning to identify a subgroup? The answer should be no. So let's go back. What is the purpose? Yeah. Never start with a method, because that will almost ultimately will lead to something, to generating some sort of evidence, which is off the mark, because, I think, you know, the person asking for that analysis probably doesn't know, about machine learning, doesn't know whether it will actually generate what they want. They generally know what they want. They think machine learning will give it to them. So I think that's really the emphasis, always purpose first and focus on the end result. And then they'll be a working the way back there, and you have to be really clear on what they want to see and how they're going to use it.
Yeah. And I think, when you just, you know, talk to maybe just a physician, it's sometimes good to talk to also the customer of the physician, so to say, be it kind of, you know, someone in marketing or regulatory, yes, or something like this, and understand what was their original request. And so you can see how it will be actually used. Where will it end up? Somewhere in the label? How will it may end up there? How do kind of promotional material should look like? So I think that's also very often quite insightful, because even between the marketing and the medical person already something may be missed. And I've seen that very often. So, you know, already the first miscommunication happens there, and then going back to the source is quite helpful. The other thing is, what's your experience with kind of showing alternative ways to answer such a, you know, subgroup generic question? And I've had sometimes quite good experience with where I said, well, we could do this, but we could also do, you know, this other way of approaching this question, and, you know, come up with a prediction score for each patient, so that you can basically, okay, if you fulfill this characteristics, that increases your, you know, probability of getting a response by 10%, and this gives you another boost of 5%, and so on. What's your experience with, you know, showing what's possible?
Yeah, and so I guess if you follow the three steps, so to me it's almost like if you have a clear purpose, you have clear definition of outcomes, clear definition of parameters, you know, that sort of funnels down the methodological options to just a few, right? So I think that already helps. And then you get to the point where, okay, we can use this or this or this, and here are generally the advantages and disadvantages of each of these. And I think there that there's a discussion on which one might be more, you know, more appropriate or more suited to the exact way they want to use it. And maybe then they might, you know, decide, oh, actually, yeah, that's a lot closer to the way we wanted to use it. I've always had an interest in using sort of new things. So that was the case when I wanted to do my first machine learning project. It was just a general, you know, subgroup analysis question. And then, you know, came up with a method. And then I just suggested, well, why don't we do this instead? You know, this can have this advantage, that advantage. You know, it's usually, I think, when you get to that point where all the parameters of the analysis are very clear. I use the word parameter now, but I don't mean the same as just the parameters. All of the specification of the analysis is very clear. Then I think the methods discussion is a lot easier to have, and I think then the teams are more open to alternatives because they have a clear idea of what they want now because you've gone through it with them, and you have a clear idea of what they want now because you've gone through it with them. So I think it's then a lot easier that the trust is in place, the communication is in place, so it's a lot easier to have that discussion on methods and to try something different. And if you feel particularly that a different method is more suitable, I think, you know, having had all of that discussion up front, it will be a lot better received to use that alternative.
Yeah, I think that here it comes down really to the leadership skill of the individual statistician, that he knows how to communicate, how to actively listen, how to build the relationship and the trust with the team, so that you can boil it down to the right purpose and the right approach.
Yes, and I think the main mistake that statisticians make is to focus on the method when they want to talk about methods. You shouldn't be focusing on the method. I think it's just focus on the result and let them pick the result that they want. And then because if the method leads to that particular result presented in that particular way, they don't need to understand what the method is, you know, what the particularity of the method is. They just need to know maybe the big, you know, interpretation advantages, limitations of that table versus this table, or that formula versus that formula, that output versus that output. And then they can pick the one. Well, you can have a discussion about which is more appropriate to have. And then, you know, they don't need to know what method you're using, in all honesty. You can tell them what method you're using afterwards. But I don't think they're really interested in the method. They're interested in what the result. And so the worst thing a statistician can do is start a presentation by saying, okay, we have two options. Method one, and some lovely formula would be the best, worst thing to do. Method two, and then go through the details of them. No. So really just, again, start from the end, focus on the result. And really you can ignore, you can probably skip the whole, you know, methodological detail. because that's really the thing that the stakeholders are interested in. It's really the result and how it can be used. So that's maybe if one big tip would be that, you know, focus on the result.
That's a good point. Okay, let's go to the step number two, which is about the endpoints. What are common problems there?
Well, so the major problem, so ideally you want a single outcome, right? You have a primary endpoint, and that's great if you have a very clear primary endpoint, and that's the most important, and all decisions in the world are made from that endpoint, then that would be really good. But generally you have multiple outcomes. The problem happens when you have multiple outcomes and you're conducting subgroup analyses or looking for a subgroup, subgroup detection. The problem is the same. You might have conflicting subgroup results for different outcomes. So you might have that one subgroup seems to be the one who benefits most on this outcome, but it's a different subgroup on another outcome. There's that problem is the first thing. And also that is coupled, of course, with chance findings, because if you have 10 subgroups, one outcome, yes, that's fairly controllable. Mm-hmm. You know, the risk of a false positive is, you know, controllable. But if you have now 10 subgroups, five outcomes, and suddenly you have five times more analyses, you're going to get some false positives in there. And how do you balance that out if you get conflicting subgroups in different outcomes? That is the main risk, especially if, you know, you want to build up some strategic, you're trying to get some strategic direction by doing the subgroup analysis. For example, if you have phase two A or B results and you want to refine your population for a phase three study, you know, you want to make sure that the population you find is going to be a population that is, you know, better on most outcomes, at least, or the primary and some secondary outcomes. So it becomes very tedious. So one of the main solutions to that problem, which is in some situations, it's actually a very easy solution. In some, it's a lot more difficult to apply, but it can be to combine the outcomes into composites so that, you know, you're almost combining all of these into one. And that way you're just having one subgroup answer. You're minimizing the probability of chance false positives. You're eliminating your risk of conflicting results, and you're identifying a subgroup that I guess is doing better on average, right? On all the outcomes on average. Obviously there are many, many ways you can combine outcomes, and that's maybe the subject of a completely different discussion, but I had a very simple example. It's very easy when you can dichotomize all of your endpoints and almost like make a scoring system out of it. It's very easy. Obviously that might be a clear example, but I had an example in the slides where this would be like a respiratory example. You can have like an exacerbation event. So, you know, they have exacerbations events or they don't have exacerbation events. That's pretty easy. And then quality of life, you can use a clinically important, minimum clinically important difference, for example, and you can have the patients that have achieved that and that haven't. So then you have, you know, four different things which you can combine in a way you want. So you can say that, well, they have enhanced benefit if they haven't had any exacerbations, or they had a minimum clinically important improvement in quality of life. That's my enhanced benefit group. Or maybe just benefit group. And then everyone else who had a negative on both of those is a group that has no less or no benefit. So that's very easy. I've combined two outcomes, and then I can do my subgroup analysis on that. But yeah, that's the major issue with outcomes. And, you know, it gets very confusing to digest all of the subgroup information when you have multiple outcomes, multiple subgroups. And that's part of the challenge with the analyses that are done for Germany, obviously, because they're being done, you know, it's four different subgroups and then a repeat of all of the clinically relevant patient relevant endpoints, and then you have a long list, and I feel the job of the German team is always very difficult because they have to digest all of this information. It's very difficult to digest, and you know, you might have some conflicts, and they have a pretty good way of trying to some conclusions from all of those analyses, but it's very challenging.
I actually think that visualizations of these subgroup and approaches are really helping a lot with understanding patterns. So if you can see, if you can sort all your subgroup analysis by endpoint, or, you know, the other way around, look into a specific subgroup and then look across all the endpoints, or one way or the other, then you can much faster see whether there's any patterns. So I get always kind of a little bit skeptical about a subgroup if there's, you know, just this one random endpoint that is there's a significant interaction and all the other endpoints there's none. Or on the other hand, if there's one specific subgroup that has an outcome, but closely related subgroups don't show this interaction, not even pointing in the same direction. Yeah, and I think here it's really helpful to see visualizations, because then you also much better see whether that is this confidence intervals just shifted a little bit, or whether there's a really big change. Rather than, just scanning through whether p-values are significant, yes or no, which unfortunately the German system does quite a lot.
Yeah, and I think, well, again, another area for statisticians to really improve on is the visualization piece. So, on your example, something very useful might be a dynamic graph where you can actually just sort, by... sort by subgroup or sort by outcome, and then you can actually visually see what's going on. Because I guess if the best way is to see all of the results in one figure, and then you can see where the subgroup is moving, and then you can see across all of the endpoints, and then you say, that one result probably. I mean, we do it for safety a lot. You have the nice little forest plots for safety, and that's generally quite useful because you can see like all of the safety in one, or at least the safety endpoints of interest in one figure, and it's very useful for making for interpreting that data, because sometimes you see that maybe one safety endpoint is looking like it's like there's a signal, but none of the other ones have that signal, even if they're related safety endpoints. So those are usually very useful, and it's also very good, of course, for identifying signals in the safety space. But you can use the same principles for subgroup analyses.
Okay. Any other thoughts about the second step in terms of getting the endpoint right?
The endpoint right is a very different question. I think it's just trying to make sure that I usually come from an approach, keep only the endpoints that are important for decision making. Don't include all other endpoints. If an endpoint is there for exploratory purposes, do it separately as an exploratory analysis. Focus really, if this is for an important decision, focus on the outcomes that are actually relevant for a decision. That are relevant for, regulatory licensing, reimbursement for the patient. Focus only on those which are important for your decision, for your stakeholder, and just keep the rest away. Don't include them because it might be nice to include. Because even I've seen it through experience. Even if you include outcomes in there that are just there because they're nice to have, down the line they're gonna confuse people. So really the key here is really to make it as lean as possible to answer the question of interest. Because generally there's a tendency always to add more in, right? Always a tendency to add more in. What if we see something on this? What if we see something on that? So just try and keep it as lean as possible. And again, I think this comes back to the statistician's leadership skills and really negotiation skills, and really, emphasizing that it's really important to stick to the research question and what is relevant to that research question.
Yeah, and I think taking a lean approach is also a nice segue into the next, into the last step. And it's about choosing the the right covariates, the right subgroup determining covariates. So we talked a little bit about kind of things like country at the beginning, but what are good steps to do there?
So, I mean, and I think all statisticians do this and it's good. So when you have an analysis plan, really list all of the predictors, make a whole list of everything that's going to be included as a covariate. And obviously, I'd say keep it as short as possible. But it's good to list them so that everyone knows what they are, first of all. It's not necessarily useful for the statistician, but it's useful for whoever's reviewing the analysis plan. So list them all. And then what I would really strongly suggest is list possible categorizations for continuous predictors. So what are the clinically relevant thresholds? So for age, for biomarkers, for weight, list the relevant thresholds. Because it's very easy to do this upfront and then not get into the situation where you're testing multiple different thresholds at a later time. To avoid that, you should define them upfront. And
that actually also includes the references where this is coming from. I think, you know, sometimes this is just coming from a advisory board. Sometimes this is coming from literature. Sometimes it's coming from guideline or regulatory request. So I think it's really important to have that within the specifications, because that way you can always come back to what was really the evidence for that. Was that just kind of a random thought at an advisory board, or is there actually, you know, a very, very good reason, like it's a guideline that talks about this threshold?
Yeah, that's very, very useful indeed. I think, yeah, people don't put very many references generally in these, and it actually would be quite useful to know where they come from, especially when you read that analysis plan, you know, a few years later, and you're wondering, why was that
exactly
threshold? And the last step would be really to decide what is clinically relevant. So what are the predictors that you're going to make clinical decisions on, and what are the variables that are just important to adjust for? So, I mean, age, if you're doing a survival analysis, age is important to adjust for, but it might not be important to make a clinical decision, because obviously age is very important to adjust for when you're looking at mortality, but it may not impact the efficacy you get from treatment. So those are really important to distinguish, because it will have some implications for the methods that you use. Another important factor to consider as well, and I think sometimes it's useful to have this discussion up front as well, depending on where your methodology is going, is to think about correlated variables up front. And then already make decisions on what you would keep. So one very simple example is if you have PROs, and the PROs have domain scores, and you want to include the PRO and the domain scores, you know, possibly in your list of characteristics, it's useful there to then say, well, if I'm doing a model with a multivariate model, which one should I, obviously, if I do subgroup analyses, yes, I can do all five, the total score and the domain scores separately as subgroups. But if I'm going to include them in a multivariate model, which one should I use? And if they make that decision up front, then that's quite useful. So usually it will probably be the total score. If they want weight and BMI, for example, they should pick which one. If there's obesity as a comorbidity and BMI, then they need to pick which one. So, you know, if you have that decision up front on the very obvious correlated variables, then that also eliminates some discussion down the end. And it also has implications for methods, because depending on what method you use, you need to avoid collinearity. Some methods you can keep variables that are collinear. At least that's already set out upfront, which ones you would keep.
Yeah, but I think even if some of these methods can deal with the collinearity, it always becomes a little bit messy thereafter with the clinical interpretation. So if you have in a tree-based algorithm, for example, one part of the tree you split by BMI and another part of the tree you split by by weight. For me, that always looks like a random thing.
Yeah. So what I like with like random forests is I'll generally include all of them in my first go, and then based on variable importance, okay, then I'll select the one that is sort of most important. If there's no real objection on, if there's no real pre-specified choice. So for example, you can see because it might be that weight is, you know, when you have biologics, things like that, weight might be more sensitive than BMI. So maybe weight would be better, and it's good to see in a variable importance plot which one is maybe a bit higher is selected more often, and then you can then eliminate and rerun it again. In the final thing, it's good to have only one, you know, one variable of all of the correlated variables, yes, because otherwise the interpretation is quite tricky. But you can use it for variable selection. You can use all of them to select your variables. If the method allows. Yep.
And it's of course good to have a discussion about that upfront, because then you can actually much better explain what in your discussion is really pre-specified and what's data driven and post hoc. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also very good to include that in any methods part of your paper. Okay, any other thing to keep in mind for the covariates?
I guess we talked about this earlier, but you know, always be wary of these continuous covariates. The problem, you know, depending on the method that you use, that will be dichotomized maybe. So you just need to understand that if you have a truly linearly related variable to your outcome, anywhere you split the patient population into two, you'll get two groups of distinct efficacy. So that's where those predefined thresholds come in quite handy. So sometimes you might just want to categorize your continuous variable, because at least then you're imposing where that break happens. Whereas, you know, if you have like a random forest and you put in a linear predictor, a continuous covariate, it'll just break it somewhere where it optimizes the algorithm. But if you dichotomize it up front, it can only pick that threshold, basically. So depending on your question, you know, you have to really think carefully what happens with those continuous covariates. Some methods you can't use, they're not regression based, so you can't use it as a linear predictor or some functional form of that.
Awesome. That was really, really good to go through these three steps. And as a listener, you can find, of course, these slides also on the PSI homepage, and I will put a link to that in the show notes, so you can look through the slides. And if you're a PSI member, you can also have listen to Nested's presentation and see the slides at the same time. So that will be quite nice. In terms of the presentation, now you received this award being the best presenter at the CS PSI conference. Generally, how do you approach presentations?
Usually when I think of generating a slide deck, I try and think about what a bad presentation would be, or one that I didn't enjoy, or one that I wasn't able to pay attention to. And I try and avoid all of those things. So generally the things that that sort of diminish my enjoyment of a presentation might be, you know, very crowded slides, lots of words, too many things in general, too many messages, trying to cram a 30-minute presentation into a 15-minute presentation, or just simply someone who reads off the slides. You know, sometimes you have very crowded slides and the presenter is just reading them. So I try and avoid all of that. So generally what I do, so PSI, those were about 15-minute presentations. So for a 15-minute presentation, I just think about, you know, what are the 2-3 key messages I want to convey? And I just think about those 2-3 key messages, and I just focus on those. So my only objective is to make sure that the audience understands the 2-3 things that I want to tell them, and just focus on that. So try and not bring in anything else, not trying not try and give too many messages. So the whole slide deck would be built around those two, three key messages, which is, you know, all I'd want to put in a 15-minute presentation. And that really, you know, when you think of a 15-minute presentation, you're not there to really educate the audience. You're there to really just inform and present something to spark interest. What you really want is for them, you know, after your presentation, they'll go and they'll look up the things that you talked about. They'll go back and see the slides. So you don't necessarily want them to learn something new per se. You want them to have an interest in learning something new. So you have to think about that when you're doing the presentation, I think. So to me, that means that you can't really go too much into the detail of things like methods. You want to just introduce a method, and if they're interested, they'll go and see more. Obviously, in a 1 hour long presentation, it would be very different, but this is for 15 minutes. And then I guess the final thing that's really important is to think of slides as a way to enhance a narrative. So if you're trying to deliver a message, you want people to focus on what you're saying, not necessarily what's on your slides. So the slide should be there as an addition to your narrative and as a means to deliver your message. And really, you don't want people to just read the slide and, you know, they already know everything you're going to say during that slide. No. So the way I use slides really is more like bullets for me to remember what to say. So it's good for me to structure what I'm talking about. And also what I try to avoid as much as possible is just words. I try to always reduce whatever I'm trying to put into slides into either, you know, colorful things, graphical presentations, pictures, some nice transitions to make it enjoyable at the same time. So, you know, there's something to pay attention to at the same time. But really, yeah, for a 15-minute presentation, you don't necessarily want self-contained slide decks where all the information is in there. You want really just that to be a medium for your presentation, for your talk.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's kind of, it's first having the audience in mind. And I think your approach of thinking about what you would enjoy and what you don't enjoy is is a really, really nice tip. And then honing on just the two or three things, like here in this presentation, we talked about these three important steps to avoid any frustrations and to guide through it. And if you have these three things in mind, then you're also nice prepared. If everything, you know, goes off script, or, you know, your presentation is, you know, the last in the session and the other presentations run over, and now you have only 10 instead of 15 minutes. Now you know, okay, what are really the three things that I want to communicate? And you can make sure that you deliver on them. And I completely agree. It's about having these first, and then the slides are just supporting you and not the other way around. I think that also came very, very nicely through in your presentation style, that you are not kind of just always looking at the slides. And because they are not that wordy, you also don't need to look so much at the slides. You can grasp directly what's on there. It's not that you read 10 bullet points and each bullet point is a complete sentence that you need to read. And then while reading, you can't listening to the presenter. It's quite easy and fast to digest what's on the slides.
Yes. And I guess, yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah, for a 15-minute presentation, you can't give a lecture. So, you know, it's, you know, obviously, they're very different, the audience, the context, the time, or contribute. You know, if it were a one-hour session, one presentation for an hour, obviously, that's more educational now. You can teach a method. You can go through the details. You know, the presentation might be very different, but, you know, it all depends on exactly, you know, what the environment is.
If you would have one key recommendation for giving a great presentation, what would that be?
It would be really just have the least amount of words possible and have figures and colors. I think that's really what's important. I know it sounds very, very wishy-washy, but yeah, I think the less there are words, the more you replace the words with images, graphics, visual representations, the more fun and enjoyable your presentation will be. And if it's fun and enjoyable, the more people will pay attention to it.
And I think it also helps you to make sure that you have your message clear and that you know your stuff. Because if you can condense it so much that you, for a single slide, you only have a picture there and you can talk to that, then you know your stuff. And to be honest, I also find it much easier to get these things through internal approval systems because
there's not very much in there
that people can critique about. Okay, awesome. That was such a great discussion about subgroups where we talked about the three steps of that you need to go through the purpose, spend most of your time there, then become clear on the endpoints that you want to look through, whether you want to combine them or whether you want to look into them one by one. All the different ways you can look into the covariates, that's the third step, and kind of make sure that you have, for example, specified which cut points you want to look into and have there the justification for these specifications there. And through that, really avoid lots of the frustrations that many people have, because it can be a quite burdensome topic if you're iterating through this very, very often, just because you didn't get the purpose right at the beginning. So thanks again, Nestad, for this nice interview.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Alexander.
Okay, and talk to you soon. Bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this show, which was created in association with PSI as much as I did. The interview was really, really nice. Thanks for listening to it. Please visit theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes, for example, the slides, the link to the slides, and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. And also check out the homepage of the Effective Statistician Leadership Program at theeffectivestatistician.com/course. There you will find all the further details. Would be awesome to have you. So, reach your potential, lead great science. You see, there's a leadership in there, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.